It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning April 12th, 2024. My dispatch comes once again from Dublin, Ireland. The country has a newly sworn-in leader this week, Simon Harris. The new Taoiseach, or Prime Minister, will head a governing coalition of two other parties besides his own, and he inherits a serious and worsening housing crisis. Probably the biggest challenge among the many that he faces. A stark shortage of homes, along with some astronomical rocketing in their costs. And as almost an obverse side to this housing problem, Ireland is beginning to develop, in common with many European countries and America in its year of a top leadership contest, an especially coarse, and I'd bluntly call it a nasty, movement against new immigrants. This is at the least ironic here, since Ireland is itself so noticeably a country of migrants, once exporting many of its people, most disastrously because of its 19th-century famine. That changed after economic fortunes altered dramatically in the latter part of the 20th century, and the land celebrates, yes, mostly celebrates its transformation now into a net importer of people. Ireland's media, and also overseas reports about Ireland, frequently attribute the extraordinary large and warm welcome offered, for instance, to Ukrainians who have fled the Russian invasion, to Irish men and women's long and deep experience of being displaced people themselves. But generalizations like that are always, in their nature, incomplete. Those eruptions of nastiness I mentioned earlier may be small, but they're significant and disturbing. They led last November to riots in the street, almost unheard of in this country south of the border, in recent times at least, and overseas reporters who came to investigate couldn't fail to find evidence of the nastiness. The New York Times profiled a small town, Roscrea, in County Tipperary, and an ongoing protest there, which the papers said has, quote, become a months-long symbol of growing anti-immigration sentiment across Ireland. One particular interview with the customary man or woman in the street in Roscrea got my special attention. That familiar journalistic device has its own workaday term of art in our trade, vox pop, from the Latin vox populi, voice of the people. In this case, the people, or the person, was a 31-year-old Roscrea resident who said, about immigrants and asylum seekers, they are in every possible nook and cranny that you can find. The sneaky creeping in of a phrase like, every nook and cranny, reinforced for me how important are specific word choices in our discourse. The Irish can rightly boast an especially subtle and responsive use of the English language. This might well stem from English having been adopted or forced upon the country by English colonizers. Irish users of English are often keenly alive to using it extra skillfully, even subversively. It's a truism, and therefore also true, that many giants of so-called English writing have been significantly Irish in origin. Oscar Wilde, Jonathan Swift, Oliver Goldsmith, George Bernard Shaw, down to more recent times with Seamus Heaney, Maeve Binchy, Edna O'Brien, Frank McCourt, Colm Tóibín, Sally Rooney, Martin McDonagh. The list could go on endlessly. My point is that the subtleties, or more often the sneaky crudities of language use, specific word choice in particular, can provide telling giveaways, important signifiers, if we properly pay attention. Certain key words may be uttered by extremists in the heat of the moment, but they very often conform to a discernible pattern. A powerful reminder of that fact came this week in extensive media reports from Africa covering the commemoration in Rwanda of its genocide 30 years ago. That terrible blot on human history, the hate-crazed killing of a million human beings, was preceded, we can say, prepared for, by a massive upsurge in dehumanizing language. In hate-filled radio broadcasts, speeches, and newspaper articles, leading extremists in the majority Hutu population were applying to their target community, the minority Tutsi people, the fateful label of cockroaches. The logic of such despicable rhetoric demands, of course, that the target, once dehumanized, must be exterminated. We can see examples of this vicious verbal predestination all over the world, intertwined often with the predictable vocabulary of racism. In Europe, Africa, Asia, and the Americas, there is to be heard the full panoply of subhuman terminology: animal, rat, vermin, ape, snake, parasite, savage beast. And it recurs and recurs. Misogyny and anti-LGBTQ hatred have long had their dehumanizing vocabulary, from bitch to faggot and way beyond. Bitch, of course, substitutes canine for human, and faggot might imply a demotion further below humanity to something of even lesser status than animal, to being a mere bundle of sticks, which was the word's 16th century usage, a bundle ready for burning. One revealing example of verbal dehumanizing as a psychological ploy was practiced by Imperial Japan's biological weapons researchers before and during World War II. The human victims of their experimentation were referred to as maruta, meaning wooden logs. One of the scientists, a Yoshio Shinuzaka, is on record testifying later that "we didn't want to think of them as people. We convinced ourselves that what we were doing was like cutting down a tree." It was probably the Nazis who were the most horrifyingly organized proponents of dehumanizing. Linguistically, as in every other way, Hitler's followers copied him in his repeated description of Jews as Untermenschen, or subhumans, an extension, you could say, from metaphor into outright and systematized ideology, leading, of course, to industrialized extermination. We in the United States, even while considering ourselves an advanced society, can hardly claim complete superiority. Even our foundational document, the United States Declaration of Independence, talks of merciless Indian savages. Savage, of course, deriving from its original use to mean an untamed wild animal. You won't be surprised that I must bring up Donald Trump and his language. But first, I'll quote the book of Ecclesiastes, and not merely because of Trump's devoted following among Christian fundamentalists. I'll simply cite it for one more truism that is inevitably true. "There is," says the book, "nothing new under the sun." And sure enough, Trump the dehumanizer is far from original. He has slithered and keeps on slithering into the familiar old tropes. At an Ohio rally, he infamously referred to immigrants as animals. And just in case some of his dimmer listeners might not get it, he spelled out what the animal epithet directly meant. And I quote, "not people, in my opinion," he said. He broadened his targets, but not really the label, when he proclaimed, "We will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country." That was delivered to followers in New Hampshire. And speaking of how he picks targets, he described the entire city of Baltimore as, quote, "a disgusting rat and rodent-infested mess." I admired, in a way, the response of that city's great newspaper, the Baltimore Sun, whose editorial said, "Better to have some vermin living in your neighborhood than to be one." The author of those words, the Sun's veteran scribe Peter Jensen, told a colleague at the New Yorker magazine, "I never in my life believed I'd be writing an editorial that described a president of the United States as a rat." The coarseness of dehumanizing language is, without a doubt, very contagious. I know, we all do, just how easily the media, especially American media, can get desensitize and fall victim to Trump fatigue. But I don't want ever to forget in exactly what tradition of abominable political language, which all too inevitably leads to abominable human atrocities, the words of Donald J. Trump so clearly belong. That's all from the Media Beat this week. Thanks for listening. Next week's report will also come from Ireland.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.